value that it was impossible, if you wanted to unpick, to really understand why it was this particular value had been put on it. It was just, well, that's what we bought it for 3 months ago, or that's what the current cost of that is in the marketplace, therefore that's what it's worth, without ever actually being able to construct a rigorous set of assumptions that would say, if all of this comes to pass, then this is what you have to believe to justify these values. So just to recap then, I think, yes, the use of one number can be dangerous, but the thing that reduces the danger is understanding the components of the things that you're valuing, the assumptions that are key to putting a value on it, the sensitivity to each, and the probability assigned to each of those key assumptions.
I think, can I say?
Yes, please.
I think what's interesting also for me on that point is when we joined Swiss Re, I hadn't ever been exposed to capital markets at all in my life. I've done money broking, but that wasn't really, that was all dodgy stuff rather than real kind of capital players, you know? And the testosterone-filled rooms I went into, where I asked a simple question, I was told, don't be stupid, that's the market price, get out of here, was shocking. And my approach is always to kind of peel back the onion, go down the path, go back to basics, and try and rebuild it my own kind of way. And the amount of reaction I got from people saying, you're old-fashioned, you're stupid, was quite shocking, actually. Because I'm quite thick, and I could carry on, I ignored them. I even did research on risk-free models versus semi modeling, read papers from Australia. It was really scary stuff, actually. And I realised there was no answer. And ultimately, you always know, is there a market price where someone will buy and sell? So you thought, well, if they're buying and selling, it must be a market, they must be right. But as you say, once the music stopped, it all fell apart. And my biggest learning curve was a good friend of mine is a lawyer who actually packed up law, partly because of this reason, and is now retired at 40 years old, that he was advising a client on a model where both banks had different models. Both banks on the same trade took money out of the deal. Now, if you do a kind of a global consolidation, that can't be right because it's kind of double entry stuff. Yeah, but they were able to move so far away from reality with their models. And your profession was part of that, by your modelling was part of that process. Create this kind of fantastic, kind of complicated vol divided by inside leg of someone's measurement, whatever, that you couldn't compare and contrast. And then it got into funny music. So I think ultimately you're right. There's a point where the market is right, then it's not right. And the classic outlier event discussion, which I find fascinating, is the outlier the actuality or an outlier is another matter. But no, I totally agree. My problem is your profession for years had an internal assumption regime which wasn't really challenged. And because you're such a very bright profession, getting in there was very hard. I developed a thing called the Seven Dwarfs as part of my marketing play to tell you that yes, everyone's doing the same deficit. Everyone laughed at that. It's still around because people were amazed by you guys who could do seven versions of the same calculation. Now you can justify that clearly to yourself, but to someone who's an accountant, having one thing was right, not seven. So ultimately, you as a profession have to actually recognise these issues and produce and drive the solutions to Louise's point, right? You've got to grab the ball and show leadership here with your views and your solutions. Not 49 different tables of mortality with no kind of guidance to them. It's that's what you're doing and why. And put a stake in the ground and move forward. You may be wrong, but it's the best step we've got. And you're the experts here, in my view. No one else is.
Thank you. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. President. Paul Grace. First of all, I enjoyed Richard's presentation. Thank you very much. I'm mainly responding to one of the questions Ronnie put to us when he said that perhaps some of the Life Office actuaries might pick up on one of the points. I spent most of my career on the Life Office side, been retired for 10 years or more now. But I'm now involved in overseeing the runoff of some closed with-profit funds. But I'm also trustee of a sizable DB scheme, and so there's one or two points I'd like to make in that connection. First of all, I think the big difference between, at least one of the main differences between the life assurance situation, the pension scheme situation, is that they're going in opposite directions on the track. The life offices realised the dangers of the guarantees they had when interest rates started to come down in the 90s and set out to reduce their guarantees by not selling business in future business, new business, with guarantees. So the guarantees are in runoff. Furthermore, because whereas the pension scheme has an employer's covenant, there isn't a policyholder's covenant in the case of insurance companies. And combined with that, with the requirements of the regulators, have led life offices to manage their guarantees and take action in the late 90s, early part of this decade, to protect themselves against adverse situations developing. On the other hand, pension schemes have seen their guarantees increase as discretionary benefits have been replaced with contractual benefits. Now, the other point I'd pick up on, Tom mentioned about the dangers with an employer's covenant of the employer taking action. In the case of the scheme where I chair the trustee board, we have in place an agreement with the employer whereby the finance director notifies us in advance of possible events that might affect the employer's covenant, and they're discussed with a small subcommittee of the trustee board, and through that we manage that type of situation. They don't suddenly come out of the blue that our covenant has been reduced. Any other comments I wish to make, Mr. President?
Okay, thank you, Paul. Brian, and then Alan.
Thanks, Mr. President. Brian Duffin, with a couple of feet, one of which is partly in life and one partly in pensions, and the other is partly in the golf course. One interesting point which Richard raised in passing was the possible implications for Solvency II, which is developing in the insurance sector, on pension funds. And that got me thinking, because the life industry has in the UK has had to develop quite a sophisticated risk analysis approach so that the cost of capital of providing the guarantees can be assessed. Now, whether that's an entirely accurate measure, we can go up hill and down dale about the quality of the models involved and so on, but it does produce something which can be used to measure the cost of guarantees. And I suspect that these techniques will be needed in the context of pension funds. Whether they are ultimately published or not, I can see there being pressure for them to be published. I can see investment analysts being interested in the cost of the guarantee that the provider, that the company is providing through its covenant. It is a strain on the balance sheet. Now, you can then go on and do some interesting things by saying to what extent are some of these risks that are tied up in risk capital for the pension fund correlated positively or negatively with other aspects of the employer's main business. Is there some real diversification involved which helps to bring down that cost of capital? But it's something which is useful for all sorts of reasons. It also gives the employer some milestones which they can set in running their pension scheme, and they can then test whether remedial actions being proposed for the pension scheme do actually help to bring down that strain in the balance sheet or not. So I think there's a lot of interesting ideas there to develop, and we may be, as industry, happily forced down this train of reasoning via the Solvency II coming down the track from the insurance industry.
Thank you. Alan?
The name is Alan Martin, speaking as an actuary and also as an independent trustee. I think I should start by congratulating you on an excellent talk, very challenging, and perhaps also for your contribution to getting the pensions regulator to where they are at the moment. I think there's been some big, very big leaps forward from the regulator in recent years, not least on longevity and on employer covenant assessment. And if I may just throw in an anecdote that one of my corporate finance advisors says that pledges, whether they're positive or negative, are simply indicative of not being able to get anything more tangible. So not wishing to sound too flippant, they can sometimes be the only thing you can get. Longevity, the regulator has dragged possibly the actuarial profession into the 21st century. It's been quite sad to see that actually being required. And in practice, I have to say, although it may be the small schemes I see, there's another big risk involved in longevity, and that's the concentration risk, where the West of Scotland engineering firm may have some big liabilities in blue collars, but there's probably 80% of the pensioners are white collars who own the firm, and that's often missed. The one big thing I'd like to highlight is that pensions regulator is encouraging trustees to act like a bank manager, but bank managers are not often very convinced by lending, say, £20 million, seeing the client blow £5 million immediately, and then reserve £15 million invested in equities and say, we'll pay you back because we've got no cash flow requirements for a wee while, and we'll just back this equity bet. So the equity bet, from my perspective, the mismatching risk that's there is by far the dominant one. And finally, if I may come up with a bit of a warning, I thought Louise was going to mention it. When we're considering messages to the executive, I think the trustee advisors have to be very careful on conflicts of interest. We're seeing that with finance directors resigning from trustee boards in greater numbers now. I think actuaries have to be very careful there as well. If I may finish with a solution, the solution for both life offices and pension funds, and for the whole transparency of the industry, is for the government to issue several hundred billion pounds worth of longevity bonds. That will give us a liquid market so that we can value our liabilities and pension schemes with what the market thinks, solvency for insurance companies. Sadly, it will also bring transparency for the public sector, and the value of unfunded liabilities will not come through. So that may be the hindrance.
Thank you. This gentleman over here, and then you run.
I'll start without the microphone. I'm also a life insurance actuary in a very small company, but also a finance director and also a lead trustee, so I do take the points about the conflicts of interest. I think I will be gradually, fairly soon, managing myself out of some of those. But you were talking all about de-risking, and I think that is crucial. I mean, we did an MBO as a life insurance company about 10 years ago, and a large part of that consisted of me persuading the regulator that here was a life insurance company that didn't actually take any risks, you know, because we were unit-linked, we had renewable this, that, and the other, we had policy fees that went up with inflation, and so on. And then I look at my DB pension scheme, you know, and the risks are appalling. And in 2008, we started the year about balanced on our funding. We were quite reasonably fully invested in equities. It's a very young scheme, and we lost 40% of the value, and had quite a big hit to our solvency as a result. And when I thought about that, I sort of thought, well, I suppose in a way I was quite lucky, because that could have happened 7 years later, you know, when my pension scheme was twice the size, and I'd have had double the size of the problem. So it seemed to me that, you know, DC was the best way of de-risking the thing. The problem there is that, you know, my reason for all supporting the DB scheme was I felt that the scheme was more capable than individual members of bearing the investment risk, certainly the timing of the investment risk. But if you think about it, when pension schemes were set up after the war in the UK, I think the average life expectancy at age 65 was about 7 years. You know, we're now up to about 25 or something like that. And, life insurance companies sell annuities, you know, backed by bonds, you know, for a 25-year horizon. What we've done in Ireland, which I think is rather sensible, is that we introduced the concept of accrued retirement funds, about 10 years ago, and this enabled individual members not to get out into equities, into annuities at age 65, but to remain invested in equities. And so it does rather take away the timing risk. You know, if you reach 65 and the stock market has fallen badly, well, at least effectively you're buying your accrued retirement fund very cheap. And it seems to me that we're waiting to see quite how things develop in Ireland. At the moment, these products are fairly restrictive. It rather looks as if they might be opened up to the whole market. And to me, it then becomes a no-brainer from where I'm sitting as to what we do. You know, all the future accruals will be on a DC basis, because with these particular products, I think the members are adequately able to bear the investment risk. And I think, you know, as where I see it, the company just can't afford to.
Okay, thank you. Ronnie. Well, sorry, we'll take one at the back, so the microphone's there, and then we'll come. Well, we'll take one at the back, and then you can go to the front. Excuse me. Right, gentleman at the back.
Hi, I'm Colin Fitzgerald, also from Ireland as well. I'm a bit worried making a comment here tonight, because I'm hoping that I'll be invited back, because it's already slightly negative. Well, that's another story altogether as well. I suppose I'm actually very worried, and that's probably why I'm making a comment. Seeing this, I kind of thought your talk tonight, Richard, was very charming. One thing that would worry me about it is that I hope you don't take this the wrong way. I think that it was like peddling what could be argued as a lot of easy answers, which normally in a period of strength, as in if this had happened maybe in the late 1990s, when actuaries were fairly confident, loads of surpluses and schemes, most actuaries I know would be at least partly skeptical and maybe even marginally cynical. And there would be a lot more skepticism and cynicism in the room. So what worries me is that there doesn't seem to be, it strikes me that the confidence of the profession here seems to be a lot lower than I thought it would be. I suppose the other big thing that is worrying me is that for me, about like obviously we've had a huge financial crisis, all that kind of stuff, but what for me really happened was that there was and it kind of hasn't really hit the radar of the actuarial profession, is that, I suppose like some of the other speakers I worked as an actuary in pensions for a little bit and life insurance for a little bit, but mainly in the investment environment and now kind of semi-retired. But for me, like what happened was that there was a very, very large money supply bubble, which grew up for about 10 years for a number of reasons. It's kind of quite a complicated thing, but it burst last year and under its own weight. And for the last maybe 6 months, the US authorities and authorities worldwide have been doing well to reflate that bubble to try and offset some of the problems. But there has been no mention of what's going on with the money supply, the absence of links between what the pensions actuaries are doing, the lack of connection between their theories and theories of the money supply. I don't think solutions can be found to the current crisis unless unless the actuarial profession and people outside the profession take into account what's going on in the money supply and have theories that are consistent with how that money supply will go up and down, and to remove risks with their assets to increases in the money supply and reductions in money supply. But anyway, hopefully I'm invited back again.
I agree. What I said appeared easy because, as I think you said over there, it's common sense. It's trying to get a language where you can talk to the corporate on the same page is difficult, because you will by default go down your complexity route. They by default will go down their shoot from the hip, gut feel intuitive approach. And trying to find a common language is quite difficult. That was it. It's not right. It's a framework to have a conversation, not an answer. The framework you produce from that, basically, is it based on your abilities and their abilities to have that conversation or not? And that's why it's easy. It's tough. Getting into it is getting the meeting, getting the agenda sorted out, getting the CEO to open up, and you to open up at the same time is the tough bit.
Okay. Thank you. We'll let Ronnie have the last word.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Ronnie Sloan. I didn't want to turn my back on our most excellent speaker. And I'd particularly like to thank him for the common sense which Robert referred to. I find that very enlightening. I'd just like to tie together a few threads from things that people have said. there was talk, I would say that I came into this business 50 years ago. I'm one of the last non-graduate actuaries. So I do adopt a very simple approach, and a number of the things that have been said reminded me of things that had occurred in the past. One element here, de-risking, you talked about. We had an issue 35 years ago when SERPs was coming along, contracting out, and we did explain the options to our clients, and about 95% of our clients did not contract out. We didn't contract out our defined benefit scheme. And I was always amazed at why such a huge proportion of final salary schemes in the country contracted out. There seemed to be a herd instinct or something going on. In particular, public sector schemes, unfunded public sector schemes. I mean, it was a nonsense because you were meant to fund the contractor liability. I think there was Brian's point about being blinded. I think actually we're blinded a bit somewhere in that process. I mean, one simple point that I mentioned to clients at that time was, if you remember, that the fail-safe option for revaluing benefits when employees left was a fixed rate of 8.5% per annum compound. And I said to people, if that's your fail-safe option, you know, you're better being in the thing. So common sense, we need to pay great attention to it. The next point, again, was mentioned about final salary scheme liabilities and cash flow projections. And SERPs gives an answer there too. Career average. Career average is a defined benefit scheme, but is that bit safer? It's less volatile. One of your buzzwords, correlation. It goes the wrong way with knobs on where things go wrong. And that's the approach that the ACA has been trying to advocate. It's a risk-sharing approach. So that one could have been toned down, the degree of exposure to risk. A point was mentioned by Louise about the cash flows. I was one who threw up my hands in horror. Depends how you want to present cash flows. And I present one example, because I was very active in arguing the case with Ros Altman on the financial assistance scheme for all these people who lost their pensions. And the government insisted on standing up in Parliament and saying, this costs £15 billion. It's totally unaffordable. They were adding up cash flows flat over 60 years or whatever through the deaths of the widows and all the rest of it. And I did, I mean, literally in the back of an envelope with Ros, calculation. We said it's more like £3 billion net present value. And so it proved to be, in fact, when the results, the figures came out. So you've got to be careful about, I mean, cash flows, yes, but look at the shape of those curves, and don't use a single figure wrongly the other way as well. So common sense is absolutely vital. So with those few common sense remarks, I hope you don't mind I'm bullying a little googly at you with all your considerable expertise in risk. Your company that went down the pan, and the 1 in 20 events, can I just ask you how many 1 in 20 events all coincided to throw off your best efforts at running that company?
Okay, thank you. I'll answer that question. I think the combination, it was the first ever concept float in the UK of an idea. Now, the dot-com boom did quite a few of those, but this was before the 96 dot-com boom. And we took a one model, a one site operation that worked very well, selling 1,000 cars a month, a big turnover, fixed price, no hassle. And the idea was to build 10 of those around the UK. Same model, exactly the same concept, raise money from the market, fund 10 models, and it would work very well. Hence the rapid growth. The mistake I made is that my team believed on the marketing story for the city without actually delivering the actual goods. And my inexperience as new chairman of a quoted company going through the roof was I believed my own bullshit. I wasn't going down the lift shaft to the coal face to check what was happening. And the guys I brought in were great CVs and great for the city, the marketplace. The market bought them. But when you peel back their skill set under duress as the market changed, they couldn't cope, nor could I. I was a new chairman of quite a company, you know, all that stuff. So ultimately, whilst I was an expert in turnaround, I couldn't turn my own company through that blip because I was seen as part of the problem rather than the solution. So the advisors coming in and the banks who are trying to rescue it, as they do, saw me as a problem rather than a solution. By the time they realised, it was too late. And we were so overgeared at the time, we were overgeared experience-wise, financially, everything else, the shock of this one in... In fact, if you look at the used car, if you're really boring about this, the used car price of the last 50 years goes like this, and that happens in May 98, and it carries on like that. And that was one. That was a one in 100 year event happened. Now, as it turned out, we'd have probably given my track record of somebody else falling over. Everyone's got, in my view, a mistake in their lives to do. You make it big. There's one thing about failure. There's certainty in failure. If you're successful, you never know why you are, really. But when you fail, you know why you failed. And that's actually quite important for me. So, yes, it was actually a rather extreme event, but actually made me a better person with hindsight, but not the time anyway. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Well, I hesitate to ask to add any more remarks of my own when we've been from Buddha to the Book of Revelation in the course of the discussion. But I do want to say a couple of things because this is what Richard touches on here is something really dear to my heart, both in the day job and through the profession. But I've had cause to do a bit of research covering the 30 years that I've been a scheme actor or whatever it was we had back in 1980. And I picked a scheme then. Its assets were 30 million, its liabilities were 30 million, and the pensionable payroll was also 30 million back then. Today, the numbers are enormous, but the key number is that the deficit is twice the payroll of the company involved, twice the total payroll. And this is a company that's actually grown. It's not one of those ones that's a fallen idol of the British thing. And it strikes me that back in 1980, the scheme was immature. You projected forward. It frankly didn't matter if you got the assumptions wrong, because it only took a small tweak of the contribution rate on that big payroll, and you were sorted. So we went a decade kidding on that we actually knew what we were doing, and it was a good decade, so our assumptions always tended to be overshot by investment markets. And I think we got ourselves into a desperate sense of security that somehow we had some masterful power to choose assumptions, when in fact we were in an unusually benign decade, and frankly it didn't matter if we got them wrong anyway. Today, it isn't about choosing assumptions, it's about managing the assets and by having those opening those conversations. And then I entirely agree with Colm, having some really quite difficult discussions about how you then do it, because nobody's got any money anymore to work your way out. And it's not it's not a liability issue, it's an asset management and to the extent that you marry the two in asset liability. And I think the sooner the profession kind of stops kidding on that it has some magical powers to choose the right assumptions and instead just bases, I mean, to the extent that we have to use discounted income values, because if you capture all the complexity of the cash flows in a single number, the market value of that is brilliant. For goodness sake, don't use the accounting numbers because it's uninvestable. There's all sorts of other reasons why you wouldn't. And to move forward, one of the difficulties is, of course, that those of us who have been doing this for a while would have to go along to our clients and actually say, you know, that way I told you we used to manage the pension scheme, that's all nuts now. That doesn't really work anymore. So it's a huge credibility problem. But once you've had the conversation once, you move into that new horizon. I would encourage all pensions actuaries to have the courage to have that conversation, because once you break through that brief moment that your credibility is short and get through the other side, actually it does make things a lot easier. The profession... I'm working with Charles Cowling to get a big research project on discount rates going so that people can use discount rates that are workable and from which accounting discount rates and all the other discount rates that people want to use and that it works across the practices life, that everybody can start working off the same thing. And then there are good reasons why for the management of those assets and liabilities one would want to deviate away
from the risk-free discount rate, but at least it'll be a common position to start from, and people will understand through credit risk or whatever else the reasons why you've moved away from it, rather than confusing the world that there are, well, when I was chairman of the pensions board, there were 14 different ways of valuing a pension scheme, you know, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, that is not helping public confidence in the profession. So thank you, Richard, for reminding us of what our clients actually want and need. And on behalf of the Assembly, Conor, thank you very much for stimulating such a discussion. Notwithstanding their inability to get the Radisson to figure out what the profession is called, the events team have almost single-handedly been doing their best to build the Scottish economy by running an unprecedented number of activities in Scotland over the course of the next few months. And if I could just recite them briefly so that you know what's going on, because as we experiment with different ways of getting information out to the different practice areas and interest groups, I'm not sure that it's all getting through. Starting on Wednesday, the General Insurance Conference will be here in Edinburgh with a lot of interesting stuff on climate change. And on the 12th of October, there is an Our Changing Future meeting, which is the profession's response to the financial crisis. We sponsored a big project from the Cass Business School on what were the causes of the systemic failure in financial markets. And that's going to be on at Scottish Widows. It's an evening meeting on the 12th of October. Well worth going along to, some interesting stuff there. Then on the 14th of October, there are two meetings on the same day. First, career support for actuaries. That's for actuaries who are perhaps thinking that they would like to change disciplines or do whatever. This has been run once in London to great acclaim. So those of you who either employ actuaries or who are actuaries wondering about changing track within their careers, the 14th of October, it's an afternoon meeting at the College of Physicians, and you can just stay in your chair at that point and move seamlessly into an evening of how to improve your networking skills. So firstly, which horse you would like to switch to, and then how you network to make sure that you master that horse. So two for the price of one on that occasion. Brian Ridsdale has organised another splendid mortality and longevity multidisciplinary conference on the 21st and 22nd of October here in Edinburgh, and it's preceded by a ceilidh so that those coming from far from Scotland can get an insight into our quaint customs. Whether you want to dance or whether you want to go and learn more about mortality and longevity, both events promise to be excellent. And then another Our Changing Futures forum on the Actuaries Code, which is the latest incarnation of the ethical code, which provides actuaries with backbone in the face of difficult decisions. And then the meeting that would have that was originally scheduled tonight on the 2nd of November, Management Actions in a With Profits Fund by James Tully. Then on the, as if that wasn't enough, on the 23rd of November, the showpiece of any presidential term, the faculty lecture, which this year will be given by Sir Michael Attia, one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, an honorary fellow of the faculty, and he will be giving us a lecture on what we can learn from the great age of enlightenment in Scotland and what we can learn from that in these difficult times. Many of you will be going to the Life Convention, which is here in Edinburgh on the 25th to the 27th of November. And then rounding off the year, what used to be called the Younger Members Convention, now called the Momentum Convention, will be in Glasgow on the 7th to 9th of December. So a packed programme, as they used to say on the Two Ronnies, for the rest of this year. Thank you all for coming. There are drinks downstairs, so please join us, and you get a chance, for those of you who'd like to have an informal word with Richard. Thank you very much.